Chapter 3. America Breaks Free. On the Monday after the Syria attack, I flew with Trump to Florida, taking my first ride on Marine One from the South Lawn to Joint Base Andrews, and then Air Force One to Miami. Our destination was nearby Hialeah for a rally boosting Trump's efforts to create a positive business climate. The over 500-strong audience consisted largely of Cuban and Venezuelan Americans, and when Trump introduced me in the context of the Syria strike, I got a standing ovation. Trump, obviously surprised, asked, "Are you giving him all the credit? You know that means the end of his job." What fun. Senator Marco Rubio, however, had foreshadowed the ovation earlier when he raised my appointment as National Security Advisor. "It is a bad day for Maduro and Castro, and a great day for the cause of freedom." I had long worked on these issues, and the crowd knew it, even if Trump didn't. Air Force One flew afterward to Palm Beach, and then we motorcaded to Mar-a-Lago. I continued preparing for Trump's summit with Japanese Prime Minister Abe, with a heavy focus on North Korea's nuclear weapons program, the main purpose of Abe's trip. Even the simple task of preparing Trump for Abe's visit turned out to be arduous and a sign of things to come. We arranged two briefings, one largely on North Korea and security issues, and one on trade and economic issues, corresponding to the schedule of meetings between Abe and Trump. Although the first Abe-Trump meeting was on political matters, our briefing room was filled with trade policy types who, having heard there was a briefing, wandered in. Trump was late, so I said we would have a brief discussion on trade and then get to North Korea. It was a mistake. Trump, set off by a comment that we had no better ally than Japan, jarringly complained about Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor. Things went downhill from there. Before long, Abe arrived and the session ended. I pulled Kelly aside to discuss the fruitless briefing, and he said, "You're going to be very frustrated in this job." I answered, "No, I'm not, if there are minimal rules of order. This is not a Trump problem, this is a White House staff problem." "I don't need a lecture from you," Kelly shot back, and I replied, "I'm not lecturing you. I'm telling you the facts, and you know it's true." Kelly paused and said, "It was a mistake to let them, the trade people, in, and we agreed to fix the problem next time." But in truth, Kelly was right, and I was wrong. It was a Trump problem, and it never got fixed. Abe and Trump first had a one-on-one meeting, and then they and their delegations convened in Mar-a-Lago's white and gold ballroom, which was indeed very white and very gold, at 3 p.m. Abe greeted me by saying, "Welcome back," because we had known each other for over 15 years. As is typical at such meetings, the press mob then stampeded in, cameras rolling. Abe explained that during the one-on-one, he and Trump had forged a mutual understanding that all options were on the table regarding North Korea, where we needed maximum pressure and the threat of overwhelming military power. Certainly, that was my view, although at that very moment Pompeo was busy negotiating where Trump's summit with Kim Jong-un would occur. The Abe visit was perfectly timed to stiffen Trump's resolve not to give away the store. After the media shuffled reluctantly out, Abe and Trump had a lengthy discussion on North Korea and then turned to trade issues. While this meeting continued, the press was exploding on something else. In the hectic hours before the Syria strike, Trump had initially agreed to impose more sanctions on Russia. Moscow's presence in Syria was crucial to propping up Assad's regime and perhaps facilitating, or at least allowing, chemical weapons attacks and other atrocities. Afterward, however, Trump changed his mind. "We made our point," Trump told me early Saturday morning, "and we could hit them much harder if need be later." Moreover, The U.S. had just imposed substantial sanctions on Russia on April 6th, as required by the Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act, which Trump detested because Russia was its target. Trump believed that acknowledging Russia's meddling in U.S. politics or in that of many other countries in Europe and elsewhere would implicitly acknowledge that he had colluded with Russia in his 2016 campaign. This view is wrong as a matter of both logic and politics. Trump could have had a stronger hand dealing with Russia if he had attacked its efforts at electoral subversion rather than ignored them, especially since the concrete actions, such as economic sanctions, taken by his administration were actually quite robust. As for his assessment of Putin himself, he never offered an opinion, at least in front of me. I never asked what Trump's view was, perhaps afraid of what I might hear. His personal take on the Russian leader remained a mystery. I tried to persuade him to proceed with the new sanctions, but he wasn't buying. I said Mnuchin and I would make sure Treasury didn't make any announcement. Fortunately, since many senior officials were all too familiar with the roller coaster ride of administration decisions, there was a built-in pause before Trump's initial approval of new sanctions would actually be carried out. A final go-no-go decision was to be made on Saturday, so I told Ricky Waddell, McMaster's deputy and still on board, to get the word out to stop any forward motion. NSC staff informed Treasury first, then all the others, and Treasury agreed it would also alert everyone the sanctions were off. On the Sunday morning talk shows, however, Haley said Treasury would be announcing Russia sanctions on Monday. Immediately, there were red flags and alarm bells. John Lerner, Haley's political advisor, told Waddell that the U.S. mission to the UN in New York knew the orders on the Russia sanctions and said she, Haley, just slipped. A breathtaking understatement. Magnetic attraction to television cameras, a common political ailment, had created the problem, but it was also a process foul. The sanctions were for Treasury to announce. The ambassador to the UN had no role to play except, in this case, mistakenly stealing the limelight. Trump called me at 6:30 p.m. to ask how the Sunday shows had gone, and I told him about the Russia mistake and what we were doing to fix it. "Yeah, what's up with that?" Trump asked. "This is too much." I explained what Haley had done, and Trump said, "She's not a student, you know. Call the Russians and tell them." That I did, ringing Moscow's U.S. Ambassador Anatoly Antonov, whom I knew from the Bush 43 administration shortly thereafter. I wasn't about to tell him what had actually happened, so I just said Haley had made an honest mistake. Antonov was a lonely man, since people in Washington were now afraid to be seen talking to Russians, so I invited him to the White House to meet. This pleased Trump when I later debriefed him, because now we could start talking about the meeting he wanted with Putin. I also filled in Pompeo on Haley and the day's Russia events, and I sensed over the phone he was shaking his head in dismay. Notwithstanding that Moscow was calm, the U.S. press on Monday was raging away on the Russia sanctions story. Trump gave Sanders press guidance that we had hit Russia hard with sanctions and were considering more, hoping that would stop the bleeding caused by Haley's comments. I spoke to State's acting secretary, John Sullivan, who agreed State bore some generic responsibility since in the Tillerson-Haley days there had been essentially no communication between State and our UN mission in New York. Haley was a free electron, which she had obviously gotten used to, communicating directly with Trump. I told Sullivan of the screaming matches between Al Haig and Gene Kirkpatrick in the early days of the Reagan administration, and Sullivan laughed. At least they were talking. By Tuesday, the press was still baying away. Haley called me at 9:45, worried about being left out on a limb. "I'm not going to take it. I don't want to have to answer for it." She denied she or the U.S. mission had been informed of the Saturday rollback. I said I would check further, even though her own staff had admitted on Sunday that she had made a misstep. I had Waddell check again with Treasury, which was getting tired of being blamed. They emphasized they had made clear to everyone on Friday, including the UN ambassador's representative, that whatever Trump's decision, no announcement would be made until Monday morning, just before U.S. markets opened. I thought that was a telling point. Treasury also confirmed they had called around on Saturday, as the NSC staff had done, to follow up. And anyway, why should our UN ambassador make the announcement? Waddell spoke again with Haley aide John Lerner, who said, "She shouldn't have done it. It was a slip of the tongue." Meanwhile, Trump groused about how the press was spinning what was, without doubt, a reversal of policy, because he worried it made him look weak on Russia. The wildfire, however, was about to break out on another front, as Larry Kudlow briefed the press on the Trump-Abe discussions. Sanders wanted me to join Kudlow, but I chose not to, for the same reason I declined to go on the Sunday talk shows. I didn't see any point in being a TV star in my first week on the job. In live coverage of Kudlow's briefing, asked the inevitable question about the Russia sanctions, Kudlow said there had been some momentary confusion and then made the points Trump had dictated to Sanders on Air Force One. Haley immediately fired off a message to Fox's Dana Perino. "With all due respect, I don't get confused." And boom, the war was on again, at least for a while. Haley got a good book title out of the incident, but with all due respect, Haley wasn't confused. She was wrong. After Trump and Abe golfed on Wednesday morning, there was a working lunch, largely on trade matters, which did not begin until 3 p.m. The two leaders held a joint press conference, and a dinner between the two delegations started at 7:15, a lot of food in a short period. I flew back to Washington on the First Lady's plane, considering this summit a real success on substantive issues like North Korea. My focus now, however, was Iran and the opportunity presented by the next sanctions waiver decision on May 12th to force the issue of withdrawal. Pompeo had called me in Florida on Tuesday evening, spun up about what to do on the Iran nuclear deal. I couldn't tell if he was still wired after his difficult confirmation process, which was entirely understandable, or if he was being played by people at State who were getting increasingly agitated that we might finally withdraw. After a difficult, sometimes testy back and forth about the inevitable criticism from the high-minded a withdrawal decision would cause, Pompeo said he would have State think more thoroughly about what would follow from our exit, something they had adamantly resisted doing thus far. I worried that Pompeo's evident nervousness about blowing away the Iran nuclear deal could lead to even more delay. Knowing that State's bureaucracy would seize on indecisiveness to obstruct the demise of yet another hallowed international agreement, hesitation at the administration's political level could be fatal. Trump stayed in Florida the rest of the week, but back in Washington, I focused on Iran. I had long believed that Iran's nuclear threat, while not as advanced operationally as North Korea's, was as dangerous, potentially more so, because of the revolutionary theological obsessions motivating its leaders. Tehran's nuclear program, as well as its chemical and biological weapons work, and its ballistic missile capabilities, made it both a regional and global threat. In the already tense Middle East, Iran's progress in the nuclear field inspired others, Turkey, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, to take steps ultimately consistent with having their own nuclear weapons capabilities, evidence of the proliferation phenomenon at work. Iran also had the dubious distinction of being the world's central banker of international terrorism, with an active record, particularly in the Middle East, of supporting terrorist groups with weapons and finance, and by deploying its own conventional military capabilities in foreign countries in aid of its strategic objectives. And after 40 years, the fervor of Iran's Islamic Revolution showed no signs of abating in its political and military leaders. I met with the UK's Mark Sedwill, then with my German counterpart Jan Hecker, and spoke at length by phone with France's Philippe Etienne. While I said repeatedly no final decision had been made, I also tried every way possible to explain there was no avenue for fixing the agreement, as the State Department had pleaded for well over a year. For all three of my counterparts and their governments, this was hard news. That was why I kept repeating it, knowing, or at least hoping, that Trump would withdraw from the deal in a matter of weeks. The news would be a thunderclap, and I wanted to be certain I did everything possible so that our closest allies were not surprised. With imminent visits to the White House by Macron and Merkel, there were ample opportunities for full discussion of these issues, but they needed to know in advance that this time Trump meant to get out. Probably. I expected, despite his wobble when I was at Mar-a-Lago, that Pompeo would instill some discipline at state, but he had run into a confirmation problem with Rand Paul. Paul eventually declared support for Pompeo in exchange for Pompeo's saying, one, that the 2003 Iraq War had been a mistake, and two, at least according to a Paul tweet, that regime change was a bad idea and that we should withdraw from Afghanistan as soon as possible. I felt sorry for Pompeo because I was sure those were not his real views. I was never faced with having to recant my views in order to get a vote or even to get the NSC job from Trump, so I never had to make the decision Pompeo faced. States John Sullivan told me later that day about his courtesy call with Paul during his confirmation process. Paul said he would vote for Sullivan for one reason only. Your name is not John Bolton. Kelly had also told me that, in the course of the Pompeo negotiations, Paul said I was the worst fucking decision Trump had made. Kelly replied, "He seems like a nice guy to me," which set Paul off on another tirade. It all made me proud. During these hectic first 2 weeks, I also participated in several trade-related meetings and calls. I was a free trader, but I agreed with Trump that many international agreements reflected not true free trade, but managed trade, and were far from advantageous to the U.S. I particularly agreed that China had gamed the system. It pursued mercantilist policies in the supposedly free trade World Trade Organization, WTO, all the while stealing U.S. intellectual property and engaging in forced technology transfers that robbed us of incalculable capital and commerce over decades. Trump understood that a strong domestic U.S. economy was critical to the effective projection of U.S. political and military power. Not, as I began to understand, that he wanted to do much projecting, which precept applied to China and everyone else. And I had no truck whatever with WTO decision-making and adjudication processes that were intended to subsume national decision-making. I completely agreed on this point with U.S. Trade Representative Bob Lighthizer, a former colleague from Covington and Burling, where we had been associates together in the mid-1970s. Decision-making on trade issues under Trump, however, was painful. There could have been an orderly path, using the NSC's interagency structure, co-chaired with Kudlow's National Economic Council, to develop trade policy options. But there was only one person who thought that was a good idea. Me. Instead, the issues were discussed in weekly meetings chaired by Trump in the Roosevelt Room or the Oval that more closely resembled college food fights than careful decision-making, with no lower-level interagency effort to sort the issues and the options. After these sessions, had I believed in yoga, I probably could have used some. I attended my first trade meeting in late April in preparation for a Mnuchin Lighthizer trip to Beijing. Trump allowed as how tariffs are a man's best friend, which was chilling, but at least he said to Mnuchin, "You're going to China to kick their ass." That I liked. Looking at me, Trump said China was strictly enforcing sanctions against North Korea because they feared a trade war with us, which was only partially correct. In my view, China was not strictly enforcing sanctions. Mnuchin and Kudlow predicted a global depression if a real trade war erupted, but Trump brushed them aside. "The Chinese don't give a shit about us. They are cold-blooded killers on trade." I could see that trade issues would be a wild ride. Macron arrived on April 24th for the Trump administration's first state visit, replete with a ceremony that must have impressed even the French. Sadly for the press, nothing went wrong. The French and U.S. delegations lined up on the South Lawn, with the President and First Lady in the diplomatic reception room, waiting for the Macrons to arrive and the military bands playing away. I asked Dunford at one point the name of one of the songs, and he asked the Washington Military District's commander, but neither of them knew. "Another disappointment," said Dunford, and we both laughed. The military pageantry was impressive, especially when the old guard fife and drum corps dressed in Revolutionary War uniforms marched in review playing Yankee Doodle. It made up for a lot of bureaucratic agony. Before the Macron-Trump one-on-one in the Oval, the press mob shambled in for the customary pictures and questions. Trump characterized the Iran deal as insane, ridiculous, and the like. I wondered if this time people would take it seriously. With the press cleared from the Oval, Trump and Macron spoke alone for much longer than expected, the bulk of which consisted, as Trump told me later, of his explaining to Macron that we were exiting the Iran deal. Macron tried to persuade Trump not to withdraw, but failed. Instead, Macron worked to ensnare Trump in a larger negotiating framework of four pillars that was discussed in the expanded meeting in the cabinet room after the one-on-one, the four pillars being handling Iran's nuclear program now, handling it tomorrow, Iran's ballistic missile program, and regional peace and security. Macron was a clever politician, trying to spin a clear defeat into something that sounded at least somewhat positive from his perspective. Speaking almost entirely in English during the meeting, he said unambiguously about the agreement, "No one thinks it's a sufficient deal," arguing we should work for a new comprehensive agreement based on the four pillars. During the meeting, Trump asked for my opinion of the Iran deal. I said it wouldn't stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons and that there was no way to fix the deal's basic flaws. Knowing of Trump's penchant to deal on anything, I mentioned Eisenhower's famous observation, "If you can't solve a problem, enlarge it," and said I thought that was what Macron seemed to be doing. It was something we could explore after withdrawing and reimposing U.S. sanctions, which Mnuchin affirmed we were completely ready to do. Said Trump the builder, "You can't build on a bad foundation. Kerry made a bad deal. I'm not saying what I'm going to do, but if I end the deal, I'm open to making a new deal. I'd rather try to solve everything than leave it like it is." "We should," he said, "get a new deal rather than fixing a bad deal." Macron told Trump in a subsequent call that he was eager to rush to find a new deal, which didn't produce any resonance from Trump. The meeting then turned to trade and other issues and broke around 12:25 to prepare for the joint press conference. At that event, neither leader said much that was new or different on Iran, although at one point Trump observed, "Nobody knows what I'm going to do, although, Mr. President, you have a pretty good idea." Later, the black tie state dinner was very nice, if you like eating until 10:30 at night. Even at that, Gretchen and I skipped the subsequent entertainment, as did John Kelly and his wife, Karen, whom we ran into as we all picked up briefcases and work clothes from our offices on the way home. Preparations to leave the deal took a giant step forward when Mattis agreed on April 25th, "If you decide to withdraw, I can live with it." Hardly an enthusiastic endorsement, but it at least signaled that Mattis wouldn't die in a ditch over it. Even so, Mattis extensively restated his opposition to withdrawal every chance he got, to which Trump said resolutely a few days later, "I can't stay in." That was the definitive statement that we were leaving. Later in the morning of April 25th, Trump again emphasized to me that he wanted Mnuchin fully ready with the heaviest possible sanctions when we exited. I also met that morning with Etienne, and my clear impression was that Macron had not briefed the French side fully on the one-on-one with Trump. This was excellent news, since it meant Macron fully understood that Trump had told him we were about to withdraw. The Trump-Merkel April 27th summit was a working visit rather than a state visit, so not as grand as Macron's. Trump's one-on-one with Merkel lasted only 15 minutes before the larger cabinet room meeting, which he opened by complaining about Germany's feeding the beast, meaning Russia, through the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, moving on to the European Union, EU, which he thought treated the U.S. horribly. It was clear to me that Trump thought Germany was Russia's captive. Trump also used a line I later heard countless times that the EU is worse than China, except smaller, adding that the EU was set up to take advantage of the U.S., which Merkel disputed, in English, as the whole meeting was. She also asked for 3 to 4 months' delay in imposing global steel and aluminum tariffs Trump was considering, so the EU could negotiate with the U.S. Trump answered that he didn't want to negotiate with the EU. Too bad he didn't feel that way about North Korea, I thought to myself. Trump had already turned to Germany's failure to meet its NATO commitment to increase defense expenditures to 2% of GDP, describing Merkel as one of the great tap dancers on NATO, which she was now doing on trade. Merkel kept pressing for an extension, even 2 months, on the tariffs, but Trump said it would be a waste of time, just like NATO. He asked when Germany would reach 2%, and Merkel answered 2030, innocently, which caused even Germans to smile, and Trump to say she had been saying the same thing for 16 months. On tariffs, Merkel finally said he could do whatever he wanted because he was a free man. Mention of Iran was desultory. Merkel asked us to stay in the deal, and Trump reacted with indifference. At the press event, Trump said of Iran, "They will not be doing nuclear weapons." And that was pretty much it. Possibly more eventful was yet another putative Israeli attack on Iranian positions in Syria the day after, which Mattis and others at the Pentagon worried could prompt Iranian retaliation, probably through surrogate Shia militia groups in Iraq, on U.S. forces. None happened, and in any event, Trump seemed unconcerned. Briefing Netanyahu on his Iran thinking, Trump said that the whole deal was based on lies. Iran had played the United States for fools, and that Israel should feel free to flay the deal publicly, which, of course, Netanyahu was already busily doing. As the days went by, I quietly confirmed with Mnuchin, Haley, Coates, Haspel, and others that everything pointed to an early May withdrawal from the Iran deal, and that we all needed to think of the decision's appropriate rollout and follow-up steps in our respective areas. Mnuchin insisted he needed 6 months to get the sanctions back in place, which I couldn't understand. Why not make the reimposed sanctions effective immediately with some short grace period, say 3 months, to allow businesses to adjust existing contracts and the like? This was a perennial problem with Treasury under Mnuchin. He seemed as concerned with mitigating the impact of sanctions as with imposing them to begin with. No wonder Iran, North Korea, and others were so good at evading sanctions. They had plenty of time to get ready under Mnuchin's approach, which was, in essence, the same as Obama's. Pompeo agreed with me that the sanctions should take immediate effect. We did score a small victory when Mnuchin reduced the wind-down period on most goods and services from 180 days to 90 days, except for oil and insurance, which he kept at 180 days. Of course, oil was the overwhelmingly most important economic issue at stake, so Mnuchin's retreat was hardly significant. And we were not talking about winding down existing contracts, but a grace period within which new contracts could be entered and performed with no prohibition at all. It was unnecessarily self-defeating. Pompeo, Mattis, and I had our first weekly breakfasts at the Pentagon on May 2nd at 6 a.m., and Mattis continued to make his case against withdrawing. It was clear that Trump had made up his mind. Throughout the rest of the day and the week and over the weekend, preparations intensified for the withdrawal announcement, particularly drafting the official presidential decision document to make sure there were no loopholes that supporters could crawl back through. Stephen Miller and his speechwriters were also working away on Trump's speech, which was progressing well. Trump had plenty to add, so the drafting went right until the text had to be prepared for the teleprompters. Although I had aimed for Trump's announcement to be on May 7th, Sanders told me that the First Lady had an event scheduled that day, so we moved the withdrawal to May 8th. Thus, our weighty matters of state disposed. And in fact, even there, Trump wavered, wondering about one date or another, literally until almost the last minute. There was a final, perfunctory Trump-May phone call on Iran and other issues on Saturday, May 5th, and Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson arrived in Washington Sunday night for further discussions. That night as well, Mattis sent me a classified document at home, again opposing the withdrawal, but still not requesting a high-level meeting to discuss it. I felt like saying that his position was well-preserved and well-papered for history, but I refrained. The Pentagon still wasn't telling us what it would have to do operationally if the U.S. withdrew, having moved from overt opposition into guerrilla warfare. It didn't slow us down. I saw Johnson in my office at 9 a.m. Monday, having first met him in London in 2017, discussing Iran and North Korea at length. We reviewed Trump's recent meetings with Macron and Merkel and Macron's four pillars idea. Johnson said they had been thinking along the same lines. I said I would be happy to call the idea Johnson's four pillars, and we all laughingly agreed. He, like Macron, stressed that Britain fully understood the existing deal's weaknesses, which would have surprised many supporters who still worshipped at its altar. I explained why the announcement would be coming soon, although knowing Trump, I did not say it would be the next day. We would not then simply lapse into inaction, but would bring back into force all the nuclear-related U.S. sanctions the deal had put on ice. As we parted, I reminded Johnson that I had said to him the previous summer that I wanted to help out on Brexit, and still did, although we had little chance to talk about it. I spoke later with Sedwill about this conversation, and was later on the phone with Etienne when he exclaimed that Trump had just tweeted, "I will be announcing my decision on the Iran deal tomorrow from the White House at 2 o'clock p.m. No suspense left there. Etienne had been watching Trump's tweets more carefully than I. There was little doubt what was coming, which I confirmed to Israeli Ambassador Ron Dermer and a few others, not that anyone needed much explanation. On D-Day itself, Trump called China's Xi Jinping at 8:30 a.m. on several issues, including North Korea. Trump said he would be making a statement on Iran shortly and asked, in an almost childlike way, if Xi wanted to know what he would say. Xi said it sounded like Trump wanted to tell him, a completely on-target insight. Trump, in a why-not moment, said that, feeling trust in confiding in Xi, he was terminating the nuclear deal, which was bad, and that we would see what happened. Xi said he would keep the news confidential, adding simply that the U.S. knew China's position, meaning Xi did not plan to make it a major bilateral issue. Macron called and asked what Trump planned to say on Iran, but Trump wanted to be sure Macron would be circumspect. He admonished Macron not to make it public, asking for Macron's word. Macron replied affirmatively, believing that Iran should not leave the deal, nor would France as they worked to achieve a comprehensive new deal, as the two leaders had discussed previously. Trump didn't think Iran would exit because they were making too much money. Trump mused that at some point he should meet with Iranian President Rouhani, flattering Macron as the best of the Europeans, and that he should tell Rouhani Trump was right. Trump delivered the speech at about 2:15 p.m., which went according to script, with Pence, Mnuchin, Ivanka, Sanders, and myself in attendance. Afterward, we all walked back to the Oval Office feeling things had gone off as planned and that the speech would be well received. A few minutes after 2:30, I conducted a close encounter with reporters in the White House briefing room, which was on the record but not on camera, so that the media pictures would be appropriately of the president giving his speech. With that, we were done. It had taken 1 month to shred the Iran nuclear deal, showing how easy it was to do once somebody took events in hand. I did my best to prepare our allies Britain, Germany, and France for what happened, because they had seemed completely unready for a possible U.S. withdrawal. A lot remained to be done to bring Iran to its knees or to overthrow the regime, Trump's stated policy to the contrary notwithstanding, but we were off to a great start. For several months after the withdrawal, work proceeded to follow up on Trump's decision to reimpose economic sanctions and to take other steps to increase pressure on Tehran consistent with his decision to withdraw from the nuclear deal. Basically, the initial plan was to bring back into effect all the previous sanctions suspended by Obama's nuclear deal and then make adjustments to close loopholes, increase enforcement activity, and turn the campaign into maximum pressure on Iran. By July 26th, it was time to hold a restricted principals committee meeting to see how we were doing, which we did at 2 p.m. in the sit room. The most interesting part of the meeting was Mattis's efforts to downplay the overall importance of Iran in the international threat matrix facing the U.S. He said Russia, China, and North Korea were bigger threats, although his reasons were vague, and I was pleased to see Pompeo and Mnuchin both push back, given that Iran was one of the top four threats identified in the national security strategy Trump had approved before my arrival. But the ghost of Mattis's protestations about taking Iran seriously would dog us right until the end of 2018 when he departed and beyond. So momentous was this meeting that it leaked to the press and was reported the next day. In the meantime, Iran's currency was dropping through the floor. In mid-August 2018, and then again in January 2019, I traveled to Israel to meet with Netanyahu and other key Israeli officials on a range of issues, but especially Iran. This was existential for Israel, and Netanyahu had become the leading strategist on rolling back Iran's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs. He also clearly understood that regime change was far and away the most likely way to permanently alter Iranian behavior. Even if that was not the Trump administration's declared policy, it certainly could happen as the effects of sanctions took hold. Moreover, given the views of the Middle East's Arab oil-producing states, there was, and had been tacitly for years, agreement on the common threat Iran posed to them and Israel among themselves, albeit for different reasons. This Iran consensus was also contemporaneously making possible a new push to resolve the Israel-Palestine dispute, which strategically could very much benefit America. Whether we could make the most of these new alignments operationally, of course, was very different. By early September, attacks on the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad and the U.S. Consulate in Basra, undoubtedly, in my view, by Shia militant groups acting at Iran's behest, revealed new tensions within the administration, as many in state and defense resisted forceful responses. The unwillingness to retaliate, thereby raising the costs to the attackers and hopefully deterring them in the future, reflected the hangover of Obama-era policies. Even 20 months into the Trump presidency, new appointees and new policies were not yet in place. If it were still early 2017, the problem might have been understandable, but it was sheer malpractice that bureaucratic inertia persisted in such critical policy areas. The debate over responding to these sorts of attacks lasted right through my tenure because of obstructionism and Trump's impulsive desires to reduce America's troop presence in the region, leading uniformly in a more passive direction. For all that Trump hated about the Obama administration, it was no small irony that his own idiosyncratic views simply reinforced the bureaucracy's existing tendencies, all to the detriment of U.S. interests in the Middle East more broadly. I was also troubled by Treasury's unwillingness to bear down on Iran's participation in the global financial messaging system known as SWIFT. There was considerable interest among congressional Republicans in stopping Iran's continued connection to the system, but Mnuchin and Treasury objected. They had understandable concerns, but invariably they pushed for no change in existing policy, the characteristic attribute of bureaucratic inertia. The real answer was to squeeze Iran ever harder and work to find more ways to comprehensively monitor Iran, not to give it a pass, simply to continue with monitoring mechanisms that could be replaced and perhaps even improved with a little effort. The NSC staff and I kept pushing on this, largely behind the scenes, and succeeded later in the year. But even more difficult obstacles to our Iran policy emerged in the coming year.